I'm Zoe Williams, and this is Counter Power, the podcast for global solidarity. It seems that the latest turn in this age of permanent crisis actually looks a lot like the crisis of 5 decades ago. Back then, the Gulf states turned off the oil in solidarity with Egypt and Syria's war against Israel, sparking global economic turmoil. Today, with apparent disregard for its own terrible record of war and occupation in the region, this senseless American administration has put the world on a similar, but perhaps even more dangerous path. Donald Trump, the cartoonish villain occupying the White House, seems determined to prove Karl Marx right when he famously said, "History repeats itself, first time as tragedy, second time as farce." But if there is a slither of a silver lining in this unfolding chaos and barbarity, the war does at least provide us with a massive further impetus to get out of climate-destroying fossil fuels on grounds of simple energy security. In today's show, we look away from the geopolitics and focus instead on how the economic system we built was coded to create this deep structural vulnerability. We ask just how bad the global energy crisis is. Are we simply at the mercy of forces we don't control, or can we take actions right now to protect citizens from another cost of living crisis that millions of people can't afford? Joining me to talk about this and more is Chris Hayes, the chief economist at Commonwealth, and Counter Power regular LSE academic Luke Cooper. And the big spoiler alert is no, we don't have to accept crippling price rises. Chris, welcome to the show. Can you tell us a bit more about the work of Commonwealth and about yourself?
So I for my sins, have an economics background. I'm the chief economist at Commonwealth. We're a think tank that focuses on questions of ownership. Who actually owns, which actors, which sectors, which parts of the financial sector have ownership of the key assets within the economy? And what does that imply for, how do workers share in the spoils? Does any of the money get invested into new productive activity for our benefit, or to what extent does it get forked out to shareholders? And also, what does that mean for society's ambitious transformations? For example, trying to transform our energy system. More recently, we've been doing a lot of work on how the legacy of privatization of utilities has often been massively complicating and holding back that transition.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Luke. Let's do some historical context. How bad is this compared to the 70s? Is there a way to meaningfully compare something that happens today with something that happened 50 years ago?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about this because, of course, we're not comparing like with like at a certain level. So the world economy today is more than 20 times bigger than it was in 1973, yeah, at the time of that major oil shock. So the world is just much wealthier, and that means it's much hungrier for oil and gas, actually. So that demand is much greater. The world population is twice, yeah, the size as well, right? Mm-hmm. So we're a bigger world, and we're much wealthier. I mean, if you and I, Zoe, went to China in 1973, and we went to China today, if we were able to get into that time machine, we wouldn't recognize a Chinese city in 1973, never mind the countryside, because the industrial revolution in that country since has just been absolutely enormous. So I think that's the first thing to say. At a certain level, we're just not comparing like with like. I think the second thing to say is that the reason that we can make an argument that this is bigger and more serious is that it's a physical supply shock to the entire global economy. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you could compare 1973 quite happily with 2022, because in 2022, some wealthy rich countries said, well, we don't want to buy as much oil and gas from Russia as we wanted to buy before. In 1973, Gulf producing countries said, we don't want to sell to friends of Israel.
Right, okay.
Now, in both of those different points of crisis, there's a choice being made, but it doesn't block the supply for the entire rest of the global economy. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, there's an absolute block for the rest of the economy. So about a quarter of the world's crude oil production, about a quarter of the world's liquefied natural gas production is shut off. So whether you're a friend of Iran, like China, you're still not getting it. There's still only a tiny trickle of production passing through. And in that sense, it's much, much more serious.
And Chris, what's actually happening when markets are setting prices? It's quite mystifying to non-economists. What are some of the mechanisms and who stands to gain from prices going up?
You know, when you do just have a supply crunch and you also have a really demand inelastic product, it means you have, you know, the increase in the price is much greater than the decrease in the demand for that. So people aren't able to just be like, oh, I'll just consume less of that and protect my budget that way, because, you know, they don't really have that choice. So it does mean that we are in aggregate poorer as a result, but it does mean that also that some companies in particular, and also some countries, get wealthier. And we saw this in spades during the 2022 crisis. There's been fantastic research done by Isabella Weber and Gregor Semenyuk and their co-authors that looked at which publicly listed and privately held oil and gas companies were making most of the profits during that crisis. I think they estimated about $900 billion or so in profits from just the publicly listed, so on stock exchanges. Wow. Those companies, about a third of that was American headquartered. And then they trace that through to who's the ultimate beneficiary, who owns the shares. And it's overwhelmingly the wealthy, as you might expect. You know, it's like 50 to 1, 1 to 50. So the top 1%, the wealthiest 1% in America, they get about 50% of those profits. The bottom 50% get about 1% of them. So it's incredibly skewed. You know, if we were the kind of shareholder democracy that, like, Margaret Thatcher promised us, then this wouldn't, the distributional effects of this would not be as severe. But unfortunately, it has been massive.
Wow, that's quite a trickle-down effect. Tiny little trickle.
Yeah, and it's also... There's a double regressive effect of that, right? Because it's not just that the revenues accrue to the wealthy; it's also on the expenditure side. The inflation, the consumption baskets of poorer households tend to be more skewed towards the kind of essentials, such as, you know, home heating and electricity. So they're also like more exposed to the inflation of that as well.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, how much power Iran has ended up having. To such an extent that you wonder why they didn't deploy it like earlier.
Yeah, and I think the tragedy of it, I mean, just a couple of months ago, was it now, you know, the Iranian regime, it's an awful regime. It's murdered thousands of its people. But, you know, the true tragedy of this moment is that it's probably going to emerge politically stronger with its rule consolidated both domestically and on the world stage. So thank you, Donald Trump.
Okay, so everybody tell me with the kind of noticeable things that we've seen, the immediate price spikes, the way they're changing lives in other countries, what, you know, I've seen some really spooky stuff, but Luke, you start.
I was thinking about what Chris was saying about the global oil market just now. And, you know, in some ways, you can think about this at two different levels, right? There's the people who are engaging in the physical movement and trading of goods. Mm-hmm. And then there's the people that are betting, in effect, and hedging their bets on the different price movements.
Yeah.
And that's one immediate, really important effect that, unlike in the 1970s, this is a highly financialized crisis. But I didn't realize before this had happened, and I suspect maybe the Iranian regime didn't realize, I don't know. But actually, the Gulf countries are really important producers of a number of different goods. A very large proportion of the world's limestone production comes out of the United Arab Emirates. And that's actually used not just in posh tiling in upper class flats in London and Dubai, but it's actually an input in the steel making process.
All right. Class warrior.
A massive amount of the world's fertilizer comes out of Qatar as well. Mm-hmm. So you have a global agriculture system that is getting a dual effect. On the one hand, they're oil energy needs are going up to run their tractors, run their combine harvesters or anything like that. On the other hand, the actual agricultural products and fertilizer they're using, you will expect a price spike there as well. So it feeds into our food system at the same time.
And what about like the immediate oil, petrol, gas use? Like, you know, people being told to work from home. I know that that hit Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. Last week, but didn't the European Commission start telling people to stop driving this week?
Yeah, I saw that. A European commissioner came out and said that we might need to change our fuel consumption habits and car share with people to work. So, I mean, look, this is a serious crisis for wealthy states too, if it carries on for another couple of weeks to that mid-April moment, then you have this real risk that there will be physical supply shortages, and that will be a new development for Western economies and very different to 2022.
Yeah, and I mean, on the transport front, it's I think a bunch of Australian cities are also making buses free, which I mean,
what
I think,
to stop people using their cars?
Yeah, I mean, just provide if there are accessible alternatives that are, you know, more efficient in their usage of those fuels, then you know, it makes sense to try and pivot people's consumption, people's transport towards that. I mean, I think that would be a bit of a no-brainer in this country, unfortunately. Like the bus outside of London, the bus networks aren't that great. We've seen a massive decline in bus routes over the last 15 years. And also, only about 40% of our rail network is electrified. So, you know, that's still if we hadn't dragged our feet so much on the electrification of these networks, then we would have better alternatives available.
Right. So do you think, when you look at the whole picture, do you see it hitting people first in food inflation, general inflation, energy prices? Or a weird thing like medicines?
It's the full whammy, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything insulated, and is there anything that's going to hit faster rather than slower?
Another one that I didn't sorry, you can yeah. come in. Sorry. Another one that I didn't know about was your phone, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the world's helium like comes out of the Gulf as well, and so helium isn't just the gas that makes your voice go a bit squeaky or something.
Oh, it's also a really important. You're explaining this to me like I'm five, which actually I want.
Apparently, it's also a coolant that's used in the semiconductor manufacturing process.
Right.
So you know, you have these like knock-on effects across the entire global economy.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that we've been learning the hard way, basically since the pandemic hit, is that you know the global economy is not just this set of fungible abstract things that can all just be represented by money that's changing hands. You know, it's real things, and they're not always interchangeable. It's also true of like fossil fuels, oil and gas. You know, you get different grades of oil that have different refinery requirements. But yeah, I mean, in terms of which goods are going to hit first, which are going to hit hardest, it really varies. I mean, the thing about food is that it really is just a direct consumption. It goes straight to the household.
Yeah.
So it's fairly immediate, and it's difficult to see what ways you can change the production process in the short time to cushion that cost shock. With energy, it's a bit more all over the place. On the one hand, it's most of it's like intermediate consumption. You know, about two thirds of our electricity consumption is businesses and energy, something like that as well. And then that feeds through the input output nexus. It's, you know, all of these different industries producing intermediate goods that feed into the production of other goods that right. feed into the production of others. The cost shock for energy really just ripples throughout that in and out. And it's quite unavoidable in that way, but it's much more hidden. The one thing I would say with electricity specifically is that the the way in which we price electricity in this country is very idiosyncratic, and it basically has the impact of making us seem poorer than we actually are.
Do you see it that you were speaking earlier about this being much more financialized as an environment than the 1970s? Obviously, the financial crash was a crash of financialization. Do you see this being as bad as 2008?
Oh, great question. Well, I suppose that's a classic sort of polycrisis question, right? That there are all of these things happening at the same time that intersect with one another in this very sort of complicated way. But, you know, the big concern at the moment, I think, in financial markets is that there's a hell of a lot of debt that's being accumulated, especially in the United States, to drive the artificial intelligence race. And it's probably unsustainable. And so, you know, that's been the thing to watch for where the next crisis and the next bailout will come from, right? So this is then adding another layer of crisis on top of that whole system. The one, like, just to make a positive remark, like, before this, the world was heading towards a glut in global oil supply. We were producing way more than we needed, and that was creating a cost pressure in the global market that was downwards. And I think that goes some way to explaining why the actual oil price right now is not perhaps as high as you would expect, given all of the things that we were just talking about. And that's one factor, is that we were heading towards a big glut in supply, and now we've got a shortage. And the other factor is that markets are just anticipating that this can't last very long because it's too serious. So eventually, Taco, Trump always chickens out, has to happen. And in the last couple of days, you've seen indications of that, because Trump has said, well, even in the event that I don't get a peace agreement with Iran, I'm going to stop bombing anyway. And that suggests that he's winding some of this back.
Do you get to a tipping point where you're in a crash, whether you like it or not, and it doesn't matter how fast the war ends, it doesn't matter how fast the Straits of Hormuz open?
Well, I mean, the crisis is really born when, like, the price impact hits the purchasing power of consumers, and therefore, like, there's a massive hit to aggregate demand that sends the economy into a slump, because then that feeds through to how confident investors feel in boosting investment, and that, you know, investment is the real it's not the majority of GDP. It's a small share of it, especially in this country. But it is the volatile factor that, you know, spells the difference often between a recession and not. And if the longer the price shock is expected to last as well, the more chance there is also of central banks raising interest rates, tightening monetary policy. And that is, you know, really when the disaster hits, because not only are you further putting the brakes on the economy and sending us into a downward spiral, but also you're putting a brake on precisely the type of very capital intensive investments that are needed to diversify away from the thing that has caused the shock in the first place. All of these technologies that we're hoping to pivot towards in order to insulate us from this the next time round, stuff like renewables, wind, nuclear, all of these are things where there's huge upfront costs and the revenues are all backloaded, right? Which means the cost of capital, your cost of, like, actually getting financing and then paying the interest or the dividends on that afterwards, that becomes, like, much, much more acutely decisive in terms of what, you know, whether the investment happens in the first place, and then if it does happen, how much are you going to have to keep paying for that through your household bills, through the price of the subsequent products.
Right.
So that's when it really there's a vicious cycle to this. we were talking about the OPEC crisis of the 70s, that actually did prompt a lot of serious thinking in Western Europe about how to basically diversify away from oil. And it, you know, people started thinking more about renewable energy, about electric vehicles, and also about you know, stabilization mechanisms. Mm. And ironically, again, it was along came North Sea oil and gas that really put the led those plans to evaporate, because it provided an easy exit.
Yeah.
Because we suddenly had just all this abundant oil. I mean, the only real legacy from those efforts at diversification was actually the French nuclear program, and now they are a lot better placed to withstand these shocks as a result.
Okay, so let's take a break there. When we come back, we'll look at how decades of disastrous policymaking has left the UK badly exposed to the current global energy crisis.
Hi there, I'm Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now, and I've got a small request. Counterpower isn't just about conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something that you can do, big or small, to catalyse change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But to do all of this, we need your help to launch the project. We know it's got great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. We're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please go to the crowdfunder linked in the show notes. And one more thing, whatever you do, don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review.
Okay, so Luke, you mentioned earlier that we've got this kind of, in fact, you both mentioned that we've got this uniquely weird structure to our energy market. First, I'd like to know how weird that is and how it works. And second, why is it uniquely bad for a shock such as this?
First of all, you know, we should always be careful, because it's people get very confused with this. We should always distinguish energy from electricity.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a lot of direct consumption of oil and gas. A lot of our gas goes into home heating. A lot of our oil, the oil and gas that we buy from various places, including the North Sea, the oil often goes into the transport sector. And then electricity is actually only about, I think it's like 40% of total energy usage. And then within electricity, you then have different sources of electricity. So and fossil fuels also are fuels for those generation technologies,
such as
gas turbines. Used to have like oil plants. We used to have coal-powered plants as well. Now gas turbines count for about a quarter. I think fossil fuel powered plants account for about a third of our electricity mix. Renewables, so solar and wind, account for like another third. About 10 to 15 is like nuclear, and we import a fair bit from France. But it means that, you know, only if the problem is gas and oil prices,
mm-hmm.
only a third of our electricity is becoming actually more costly to generate.
Yeah.
The rest of it is stays the same, more or less.
Right.
But where it really starts to get tricky is the way that electricity prices are set in wholesale spot markets. So this is when your energy provider, whether that's like E.ON or Octopus or whatever, they go into the wholesale markets and they purchase the electricity from those generators in order to pass on to you. And the way that the pricing works is that for every half hour slot, the generators submit what price they're willing to produce at. And then you put that in order of like cheapest to most expensive. And then whatever the cheapest sources that is necessary to fulfill 100% of demand for that moment, that sets the marginal price.
Right.
And then that price gets copied and pasted onto the rest of the mix.
Right, okay.
And in, you know, this was designed, you know, during a period when there was, it was expected that these different sources could all compete on more, you know, on a more standardized basis, right? You know, if I'm able to sell electricity for cheaper than that guy, and his price is what sets the price, then I make a profit. Good for me. That's my reward for being efficient. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you have these crazy shocks, it's not, it becomes way more than just your reward for being better than the other plant or more efficient than the other plant. It just becomes essentially rents that are being accrued to these firms that were not, they didn't undertake these investments in the first place because they expected these massive windfalls. A lot of the wind farms or whatever, they were undertaken with much more sober expectations. Mm-hmm. But along come these shocks, and they end up making massive windfall profits. On top of that, a lot of the legacy renewable firms as well, they will also be receiving subsidies called renewable obligations on top of that.
Yeah.
And also the marginal price that's being set by gas, that also includes the carbon price that, you know, the gas plants have to pay because they're emitting carbon. But that price then gets copied and pasted into the price wind farms or nuclear plants are receiving despite having... not having the same carbon output. So it's it means that basically, even though the gas shock does, or the fossil fuel shock does make us poorer in aggregate, the pricing of electricity makes us seem even poorer than that.
Right,
it basically,
right.
You know, it amplifies the shock in a way that ideally it shouldn't have to.
Luke, do you remember, like, a couple of years ago, people started talking about separating renewable from fossil fuels in the energy market, so they were just priced differently?
Yeah.
Would that be preventing some of this if it happened, if we'd done it?
Yeah. So as Chris was explaining, like, the most expensive energy sets the wholesale price. And so I think in 2025, it was something like 97% of the time the price was set by gas because it's so much more expensive.
Right.
So this then creates like an absurdity of a problem, right? Because you have an abundance of cheap, plentiful, renewable energy in the system, but you're dramatically overpaying for that renewable energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you weren't doing that, then the overall costs of the energy that people are using to heat their homes or to run their steel mill or whatever it is would be much, much lower. So it's a real broken, faulty energy system in the UK. And, mm-hmm. You know, as Commonwealth have been showing, it's perfectly reformable.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And do you think the energy... I mean, what do you think... I suppose this is to either of you. How... Is this feels like the right time to build that case, to start the conversation rolling on those reforms?
Yeah, and Chris, I would be interested in like what you think about this, because in some ways, Ed Miliband is saying the right stuff on this. You know, he makes the perfectly correct point that this shows the existential case for getting out of climate destroying fossil fuels and having secure, safe, renewable energy. And I'd just be interested in like what's he saying to Commonwealth when you come along to him and say, you know, shouldn't you be changing pricing in the energy market, because that's the one lever, a technical lever you can pull to make prices that much simpler.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is both within government and within like policy making circles more generally like a renewed urgency or sort of a renewed attention to the urgency of these kind of reforms, because, you know, 2022 drew everyone's attention to the problem, but then it just as momentum started building towards actually reforming it, the crisis kind of faded away. And, you know, there was a complacency around that depth of crisis ever recurring. And it came back again pretty soon. So I now
really fast. Actually.
Yeah, and yeah. Now I think there is an understanding fairly across the board that you know that something does need to be done on this. And I think it also presents a real challenge to the kind of case for decarbonisation that Ed Miliband and others have been trying to make, which is that they've been resting a lot on the argument that gas is the source of this of these elevated prices, and that but then they've really been not necessarily assuming, but I mean they've been encouraging a belief that all you need to do is just decarbonize and eventually...
Right, and it will just feed through.
Yeah, for one thing, just assuming that we'll just build enough renewables and then that will just push gas out of the mix and then we won't be susceptible to these shocks anymore. I think it was always a bit of a fairy tale because we're going to be... firstly, the length of time it takes to actually like build these... Yeah. Firms would be far too long for it to relieve the cost of living pressure, and in the meantime, you still have these massive rents for private companies.
So you're in this territory, yeah. Though. I mean, do you see a lot of pressure on policymakers in this direction? Do you see policymakers understanding it? Do you see it happening in the short term?
They're kind of running out of options. I mean, the cost of living has already become, you know, a noose around the neck of this government. There's massive momentum on the far right to blame net zero specifically for all of this. The cost of the promises that they've made on cost of living have not materialized. So I think the real question is, devil is in the detail. There are different ways of decoupling the price of electricity from the price of gas, and does the government have the courage to upset some of the firms who are making some of these windfall profits?
Well, is that the critical question? Because I've also heard the argument that some civil servants say that it's too complicated to disentangle the price of gas from the rest of the market. What do you guys say to that?
I mean, it is complicated, right? I mean,
they've got a point. So say you pull, you know, you pull the lever. Is it something that the government can do within 6 months?
I don't know about 6 months. I think
So it's not really a very clear technical lever pull in that sense.
You know what they say. How to eat an elephant. I mean, you have to start doing it to know how long it will take. I suppose what is puzzling to me is, as you say, all the energy on the far right is to blame net zero. I think this is going to suck a lot of the life out of that because everybody can see that it's not net zero causing massive oil shortages, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody can see that the crisis isn't caused by too little or too much wind. Mm-hmm. So how do you maximise the political... possibilities opened up by that?
I think you've answered the point, right? That, you know, right now in consumer markets, there's lots of people looking around and saying, in the United States even, I might get an electric car, actually.
And there's an
uptick of interest. I think on those kinds of basic indicators that we have, you know, we can see that this is a push away from that. I mean, I think there's lots of confusion out there around the question of, you know, maximising North Sea oil and gas. So there's some crazy data that's come out in the last week that shows the majority of Green voters are quite favourable to that, which is a sign that the Green vote is shifting a bit, but I think also just a sign, and I guess this is supporting what you're saying about the power of far-right misinformation, Zoe, that, you know, definitely Nigel Farage and co. have put something into the ether that is connecting with people who don't realise there isn't a lot of North Sea oil and gas left, let alone anything that could move prices in global markets. I mean, that's just preposterous.
Yeah, it's just dregs, right? That's correct.
Exactly. Yeah.
But at the same time, I wouldn't be like quite as dismissive of like some of the criticisms that these people have made of net zero, because you do. I mean, I mean, really, the problem is not decarbonisation itself, but whether you embark upon these massive transformations in a coordinated way. And I think that's where the UK has really fallen down. And that's how you end up with these kind of absurd situations where, you know, we're sometimes paying huge amounts of money to wind farms to turn off their production because we don't have the grid capacity to carry it from the source of generation through the demand centres. And I think that kind of rightly angers people. I don't think that accounts for the scale of the crisis by any measure, but it is a dysfunction that is sort of symptomatic of a really disorderly approach to decarbonisation. And it also highlights some of the problems that you get yourself into when you're really relying on private investors to do all of the legwork for this. Because, I mean, a lot of the reason these wind farms are in the wrong place is because we've engaged in these de-risking mechanisms where we're basically trying to like guarantee revenues for these developers for decades at a time, essentially regardless of circumstance, and in doing so, we're often curtailing our own policy space to adapt to circumstances. So I do think there is, it doesn't so much lend credence to the far right as well, but it is a warning to, I think, some of the advocates for net zero that you can't be agnostic about the political economy of it at the same time. It's not just about being green. It's about putting some state capacity towards it as well.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Okay, tell us about regional energy boards. Commonwealth have talked about them. What would they help in this case, and how fast could they be instituted if anybody took them up?
Yeah, so I mean, so this is a proposal that's been put forward by the academic Stephen Hall for Commonwealth, and it's basically the idea that the retail market is broken in this country. So these are, you know, just essentially trading companies. They don't have any assets. They're buying electricity from the wholesale market and they're selling it to customers. But at the same time, they seem to be creating more problems than they solve. And we propose replacing them with area boards. So basically, if you're whatever region you're in, according to like where your local grid is, you have a permanent public energy retailer, and they handle the consumer side of things. And this helps with a few things. For one thing, it helps protect low-income, vulnerable consumers in the immediate term, and it also helps with the larger projects of area-level and household-level investments in housing retrofit, insulation, smart, clean energy stuff. So, you know, rooftop solar, and batteries, smart heat pumps and EV chargers, and all of those big investments that we've been trying to deliver through this mishmash of energy retailers and local authorities is kind of being botched at the moment. And this is a way of rationalizing that process. On the protecting consumers in the short term point, I mean, one of the things is that renewable energy is also kind of creating competition between consumers. So it's only, you know, wealthy and engaged customers who firstly shop around for the best tariffs and everything. And they're also the only ones who invest in, you know, the rooftop solar, the EV chargers. And it's disproportionately poorer households who get lumped with the default tariff and who don't have the capital for those kind of, to enjoy the benefits of net zero. And then you end up in situations where, like, in the middle of a windy night, wholesale prices go negative because there's loads of wind coming online. Mm-hmm. In those instances, rich people get paid to charge their Teslas, basically. And the people who are paying that is, you know, it's not the wind farms who are picking up the bill for that. It ultimately gets cross-subsidized by households who are on worse tariffs and have worse energy situations. So Rather than rely on the Ofgem price cap to protect them, or try and administer social policy through this very sort of unstable layer of retailers, one thing the energy, by having a public regional energy board, could do is you put these households on the best tariff automatically, rather than relying on individual initiative. And then you can also finance a lot of the household level investments on a permanent basis, because these are long term investments, and you can't really do that with short term relationships.
Yeah,
I think what's interesting about the proposal is that it integrates lots of different things. So one is like a regional economic planning level. Mm-hmm. One is household income. And the third is the renewable energy transition and the decentralization of our energy sources and our energy mix. So I think this is a really elegant solution. I suppose what some people might be wondering in our audience is, how does this figure in relation to, you know, classic progressive demands about bringing energy producers and energy retailers back into public ownership? Mm-hmm. I think what's clever, if I understand right, about this proposal is that it somewhat dodges that question, right? And maybe you could explain that for us.
Yeah. I mean, basically, it's capital light, as we say. It's, you know, as I was saying, the retailers themselves don't have much in the way of fixed assets. So it doesn't really cost much fiscally to replace that. And it then means that you have at least one lever within the energy system to enact greater, more ambitious, more long-term projects. So like if you were looking to bring more of the system under public ownership, you know, whether that's like the distribution networks or stuff like that, this is a natural first step towards that, and it's something that you can do very quickly, like within this parliament.
Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what this all means for UK politics.
Hi, I'm Daisy Pearson from Global Justice Now. We mobilise people in the UK to transform the economy so that people come before profit, acting in solidarity with those fighting injustice, particularly in the global south. Alongside allies all over the world, we challenge corporate power and fight for a more just and equal world. I'm here to tell you about an exciting event we have coming up, focusing on a critical issue of our times, big tech. The technology that underpins nearly every aspect of our lives is controlled by a tiny handful of corporations. They track us, monetize our attention, lock us into their platforms, and use their power to bully governments and shape the world to their advantage. And it's not just about money. In their search for profit, they're fueling division and advancing the far right globally, facilitating a vast transfer of wealth upwards, intensifying automated warfare, and accelerating environmental destruction. But the good news is it doesn't have to be this way. We can fight back and reclaim technology from unaccountable monopolies as something that serves communities, not billionaires. This is why we're hosting Resisting Big Tech Empires, The Fight for the Future, a day of talks, debates, and workshops with incredible international speakers, including the one and only Cory Doctorow. If you've not heard of him, he's a multi-award-winning novelist, a longtime internet activist, and a dazzlingly entertaining speaker. So come and join us on Saturday, the 25th of April, in London, to learn, connect, organise, and fight for a tech that puts people and planet before profit. Reserve your free place using the link in the show notes before they book up. Now, back to the podcast.
I'm not saying that we haven't made good on a promise, but the promise of at the start of the episode was we don't have to just accept another cost of living crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the promise, wasn't it?
It was the promise, but how do we not accept that?
So, not to sound like an Ed Miliband fanboy or something.
You're kind of allowed to.
Well, look, I think he's got a point in terms of the actual cost effect of this crisis when he says that we are not price setters globally. So in that sense, we are fundamentally inhibited in what we can do, because the UK is a net energy importer and we buy from global markets, and that fundamentally squeezes the kinds of price control mechanisms that we could use at a domestic level. On the other hand, we do have a price control mechanism that was originally Ed Miliband's idea. So we have, and the Conservative Party and then introduced it.
Yeah, they introduced it.
So we have the fixed price tariff after calling it communist and stuff like that. So, you know, Ed Miliband has been all over this issue for a long time, going back to the original like climate change legislation passed in the UK. So I think he does know his stuff, and there are limits to what we can do. On the other hand, that does then pose the question, if the price shock ends up being really severe, does it put us back in the terrain of a Liz Truss level like bailout?
In terms of the impact on UK politics, it's a huge question, because it could have a COVID impact and make everybody just line up behind their prime minister, or it could have a Liz Truss impact and make everybody resign at once. So I ask you both this in the spirit of who the hell knows, but how do you see this playing for both the government and for the fragmentation of politics generally?
I don't know that, like, Keir Starmer has just had to deal with so many crises that could have produced a rally around the flag effect.
Yeah.
And it hasn't happened.
I know, but...
I mean, what do you think? I mean, like, it just seems doubtful to me that he could generate that kind of response. I mean, I was looking at some of the polling on his handling of the Iran crisis, and most people in public opinion, or most British voters, think that, you know, basically he's opposed to the war. I mean, you know, they're not very familiar with the fact that American bombers are using RAF Fairford and stuff like that. They think he's opposed to the war, and they kind of like that he is. But it's not reflected in Labour's polling or Keir Starmer's personal polling, right?
No, but, I think you think rallying around the flag is more rational than it is. I think it's like just, it's the don't change the pilot while you're crashing thing. So there aren't many crises that can produce an emotional reaction. I would say COVID was one. I would say the financial crash was one. But the cost of living crisis, 2022 to 2023, it just made everything miserable. It didn't make everybody go, oh my gosh, I've got to love my neighbour and join a mutual aid group. It made everybody miserable. So if this were, like, you know, obviously as a waypoint to the inevitable misery, if it were to create genuine bizarre things, you know, people running out of medicines, people worrying about each other, I think that could ironically stabilise the government a little bit.
What do you think, Chris?
I mean, the one thing that we did have from 2022 was there was a wave of Labour militancy that did come out of that. That was the sort of like the one thing that did seem to be. I mean, you know, there was the hot strike summer, as they called it. But I think, you know,
Labour,
clearly
you
didn't come to much.
You mean small L Labour?
Yeah.
I was like, I don't remember Labour. Not since the 80s when you guys weren't alive.
But yeah, I mean, I also think that the pandemic was also, it presented this point of like everyone having the same experience and like the sheer sort of novelty of it was also created that sort of unifying atmosphere. But also, I mean, also it kind of just sent people a bit crazy over the long term, like being, I think actually in looking back on how it changed the way people's trust in institutions, it was actually also very corrosive as well. So it's,
okay, well, that, I mean, if I were Keir Starmer really listening to this, I wouldn't take a huge amount of hope from that. What about in the kind of, I mean, it must surely just on a kind of gut level rally support around the Green Party, because people are going to look at this and think, how come, you know, there are a number of things we could have done that would have got us further away from fossil fuels, and we didn't do them because of the kind of politics we have.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I thought the Greens might have reached a ceiling at a certain point in their polling, but that doesn't seem to be happening. It does seem that now national opinion polling has this post-Gorton and Denton by-election effect, right? So you really see Reform and the Greens in first and second place,
but just which out of just interest,
seems quite shocking.
What did you think interesting. Before that, when you said you thought they had a ceiling, what did you think that ceiling was?
In public opinion, I don't know. I would have guessed like 17-18%, and they seem to have gone way past that now in the latest polling.
And at Commonwealth, I mean, presumably you're not politically party politically affiliated, but are all of you Greens?
I actually don't. I mean, I think there's a
there's too polite to ask your own colleagues.
People who've like spoken to the Green Party as well with. We've been talking with Zach Polansky on like some of the cost of living crisis stuff about the perils of privatization, but you know we are clearly like Labour's going you know through the floor. Your party doesn't exist really. Green Party is also like seems to be the only game in town, and like you say, Gorton and Denton has really kind of shattered the monopoly on. Like anti-right politics that Labour had been just clinging for dear life to for a long time.
I know. Neil Lawson called it a coercive stranglehold. And I thought that was strong. But that has
what
been.
What was he referring to?
The so late Labour's, what Chris was just saying, just Labour like squatting on the space of anti-right feeling and just claiming it.
And it
is a stranglehold and it is quite coercive because it you know they occupy the space and they don't really reflect the views of the people in it.
Hostage situation.
It's like being hostage. I know.
I think this is an interesting great moment for like Commonwealth, right? Because the problem for you guys in talking to the Greens in some ways is they'll just say, oh, yeah, we agree with everything you say, end of. But actually, there's much more to it than that because there's this technical exercise in some ways of preparing through think tanks what a green government could actually look like in the future, right?
And how they would
contribute directly to this sort of structural transformation. And I think what you were saying earlier about, you know, yes, we know, fixing hands up, fixing the wholesale energy market is complicated, actually. It's not just a simple silver bullet. It will be very challenging, I think, for a party that has been, by definition, a protest party or an insurgent party for its entire life. And actually think about the nuts and bolts of what implementation is going to look like and mean.
So I just want to recap, because we're nearing the end, I want to recap on not wasting this crisis. What we've got so far out of this conversation, out of your work at Commonwealth, is that, you know, it's a really good moment to remember that fossil fuels are bad. It's bound to have a boosting effect on the Green Party and their kind of, not just their kind of popularity, but their kind of heart, their practical preparation. It's going to introduce a lot of ideas into the public domain, which are easy to ignore when you don't need them, but seem quite prescient, like the regional energy boards and the redoing the pricing. What else? Is there anything that's making you think this something might good come out of this?
Yeah, well, what everything you just said was
like
the case for optimism.
Anything else?
I think Commonwealth priced in like their calculation for what changing the wholesale energy market pricing structure would look like, right? And that could, once implemented, take more than £200 off the average bill. So if you're able to technically get into a position where you pull that lever, then that's going to be really transformative for millions of people potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a political pessimist most of the time, but I do think eventually these kind of crises do sort of you can muddle through them by like just this aggregate unwieldy sort of pile of patches over time, but eventually the patches just become really incoherent and a mess. And I think these crises do eventually force you to confront the fact that a system reset is needed and that you do just need to sort of like rewrite the code from scratch. And I think more parts of the political spectrum are kind of coming around to that.
Chris, thank you for coming on the show. You've put me in a good mood anyway. Luke, thank you for your optimism and sunny nature.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Zoe, as always.
Thank you for having me.
And yeah, that's all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Counterpower is produced by Another Europe is Possible, Global Justice Now and Stop Trump Coalition. Our aim is to bring together experts and activists to talk about global justice and inspire you, our audience, into action. So if you don't know our networks and organisations, look us up. Get involved. There's a lot to do. Also remember, you can help Counterpower by keep going by hitting the link in the show notes for our crowdfunder. And whatever you do, don't forget to like, subscribe and follow Counterpower. Maybe even leave us a nice review. We'll see you again soon.